Welcome to Podcasting Them Softly's podcast series for your eyes only on the James Bond films. My name is Tom Zielinski. Today, the most excellent Frank Mengarelli and me will be discussing the 14th 007 picture, A View to a Kill. Released in 1985, A View to a Kill is the seventh and final film that starred Roger Moore and the third directed by John Glen. The film borrowed most of the Ian Fleming short story From a View to a Kill, dropping the from, the cinematic version has nothing at all to do with literary. It is an entirely original screenplay by veteran Bond screenwriter Richard Maybaum, collaborating with Michael G. Wilson, the third Bond film he put pen to. The quite excellent From a View to a Kill was published with four other Fleming short stories as a collection in 1960 entitled For Your Eyes Only. We may have a few minutes towards the end of this podcast to discuss developments regarding No Time to Die. So let's get into it, Frank. How are you doing, RG?
I'm doing very well, thank you. It's good to be back. It's been a bit since we did Bond, and we had stuff going on, which is all good.
And the holidays, exactly.
And the holidays and all that good stuff. And
but
then,
it is great to be back. Great to be back.
It is. It is. It's good to talk about a film that came out on my birth year, which I didn't realize till I looked it up.
You're a baby.
I know. That movie is 34, 5 years old.
Jeez.
Which is nuts.
Isn't it?
So I'm excited to talk about this because I'm the Roger Moore champion on our James Bond series. And we've brought this movie up a couple of times leading up to actually doing the podcast. And like I was kind of just mentioning to you before we started recording, is that I'd often dismissed this movie and kind of thought it was a joke, which there are elements to it which we'll get into. But upon this rewatch, I had a different reaction to it, and I found that I just had so much fun watching it. Now, I feel like I've gotten to a point in my life, though, where because the internet's really shitty when it comes to a lot of stuff, I find that I dig in and just enjoy everything of a respective franchise that I like Star Wars, and I feel like James Bond is becoming another one of those, although that franchise is not nearly as scrutinized or whatever. I mean, there's the whole casting thing that happens from time to time. But anyway.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It gladdens my heart. I watched it again. I actually watched it with the commentary with John Glen and a couple other cast members and crew. But I can't say that my opinion meter has wavered at all upon this last rewatch. So I'm interested to hear more about your thoughts.
Which is as expected, right? Which
yeah,
I get.
Pretty much.
Which I get. So we'll play crossfire.
Sure.
When it comes to A View to a Kill. I know that we will agree on a lot of the strengths, and I know we've brought this up before, and I just want to talk about the opening to this movie and how it's just not really that good. I think the opening is probably the worst part of the movie.
Well, it's not. It certainly ends terribly, but I can think of a couple other scenes that are very cringeworthy as well. The skiing is fine. The skiing is fine.
Skiing is fine, and then like him snowboarding
is fine,
is cool, but obviously the Beach Boys song, which you always bring up, that it's not even the Beach Boys singing, is just, it's like, it's repugnant.
It is repugnant. It's unforgivable.
It's so bad.
I don't know what they were thinking.
And it's not fun. Like, I don't, like, and the thing that we always discuss is how each movie is kind of a reflection of the cultural times or political times or socio-political, what have you, times when the film was made. And sure, this film does get into it. But that, like, I don't understand that whatsoever.
Well, it was John Glenn's idea, he said in the commentary. And he was always looking for ways to give the films, and this is a quote, give them a humorous spin. So it's like, oh my God. And it, to me, and he had some good segments that he directed, it demonstrates to me why he was mostly wrong as director of the Bond films. Flat, went for the cheap laugh. He also said something about visual humor, because they were trying to sell the films internationally. So visual humor was the easiest way to appeal to an international audience, whereas the spoken word or witticism might not come across in all countries as funny. So that's what he went for. And just going back to the Beach Boys part is unforgivable.
It is. It's not good, and I don't think it's funny or fun. No. It's like obnoxious, and it's just near the point where it's cringeworthy, and I dread every time I watch this fucking movie. I dread the knockoff Beach Boys singing the Beach Boys. I don't even know who sings that.
They couldn't even get – I had it written down. They couldn't even get the freaking – they wouldn't even pay for the Beach Boys to do it. It's like – or use get the rights to use that song. It's like, what? Jeez. It was a glaringly bad decision to include the song, but then not to even have the Beach Boys was like a double insult.
I mean, and then it gets quickly shored up with Duran Duran's A View to a Kill, which I know we're both in agreement. I think that's one of the best Bond theme songs.
Yeah, it's a great song. It's a great Bond theme, and it even actually it's a great theme. I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Duran Duran. Thank you, John Barry. Great collaboration. Great job. And it even improves the rather lackluster Maurice Binder title sequence. Derivative and it was just it wasn't exciting. They in lasers now. They got lasers coming out of Bond's PPK. It's like, ugh. What
were
they
thinking?
It's the
80s, man.
It's lazy, man. It's lazy.
It's the 80s, though.
I guess.
They got to get with the times. And you brought up John Barry. I think the score in this is very good.
The melody is terrific from A View to a Kill. It's a touchstone throughout the film. The cue is used throughout the film, and it does – it works well for any relationship between Bond and Stacey Sutton.
All right, so strong points. And then we'll get to the weak points. Let me get this up on IMDb. So the strong points, Christopher Walken.
Indeed.
I think what's interesting about casting Walken is this is like the first time, and I don't think they went back to this until Javier Bardem in Skyfall. But because they had both already won an Oscar, and what I mean by this is Christopher Walken was an established actor that everybody knew. And I think one of the cool things about the Bond franchise is they had always been very cool with their casting in sort of, I don't know if you would say like an international way, but in a way where they would cast the villain that wasn't necessarily a household name.
True.
Sure, there's a couple of exceptions like Christopher Lee, which predated that. But it's just kind of interesting how they cast Christopher Walken and then Grace Jones, and they're almost bigger. I don't want to say they're bigger than the franchise. I don't know.
Was Grace Jones bigger in 1985? I don't know really. I know she was a singer and a musician, but I don't believe that I knew of her work before A View to a Kill. And was she big? I don't know. I mean, avant-garde audiences.
Yeah. Okay. But you're correct there. So I'll pivot back to Walken, but it's just an interesting casting.
Sure. Oh, very interesting.
Of bringing someone in that's so big. And I agree. The big rumor had been that David Bowie had been courted pretty hard for that role, which that would have been fascinating to see David Bowie as a Bond villain, especially if the movie was made the same way it was made, right?
Yep.
It would just be this very interesting sort of film, because I think what the film struggles with are a couple of things. It's Roger Moore being a little older.
The first time you see his face on screen, it looks like he had toothpicks in his eyelids to keep his eyes open. He had obviously had work since Octopussy, and the work was not well done, and his hair looks funky too. He looks really bad. Roger Moore never looks bad. As James Bond, as 57 years old at the time, he looked bad.
I think he looks better as the movie goes on, but it is a little startling the first time you see him.
Ooh.
But I think the movie struggles with how to be very selective in how they film Roger Moore because he is older.
I think they do a lot of soft focus, too, just to try to lighten the wrinkles and hide them a little bit. There's a couple scenes where it looks soft focus to me. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I do. And then I think it struggles with kind of what you said with John Glenn about, like, trying to incorporate humor into the film. And it doesn't really work for me.
It doesn't work.
The thing I like about Roger Moore is I kind of like the campiness, and I know that's a thing a lot of people don't like, but I think he's very good with the humor of it. I don't think it works in this film. And then I think this is A View to a Kill is a very good example of when the franchise started to struggle to maintain relevancy. And I think that is the casting of Christopher Walken, the casting of Grace Jones, getting Duran Duran to do the theme song. I think they knew Roger Moore was done, right? And they had to figure out what to do next. And I think there are kind of benchmarks or milestones within the Bond franchise where you feel that they are maybe struggling with relevancy.
Oh, definitely. Actually, the next film, The Living Daylights, released in 1987, was the screenplay was written with Roger Moore in mind. Now, reportedly, I'm not sure that would ever be, could ever have been really a reality. But when they got Dalton to come in, they did adjust the screenplay accordingly. But some of the stuff, if you notice, and even when we talk about The Living Daylights, we'll get to it, it's a lot of campy, funny joke stuff. But anyway, I agree with you. Going back to Christopher Walken, if I can, he's a great actor, one of my favorites. As Max Zorn, he came across as a genetically engineered madman. He was insane. I found it interesting. I just read recently in two scenes which is in the mine when he's machine gunning the workers, which is like, you never see that in a Bond film. These guys were innocent.
Right.
They weren't like another villain's army or whatever. He was shooting these guys innocently just because they worked in this mine. And he began to laugh. The character laughed. Christopher Walken said he just found the whole scene so absurd that he started laughing. And then they kept it in the film, which I find kind of interesting. Then also at the very end, when he's on Golden Gate Bridge with Bond and he's holding on for dear life, and then he realizes he's going to fall and he starts laughing maniacally. That was also Christopher Walken saying, I just found the whole thing so absurd that I started to laugh, and they left that in. So it actually works for the character because the character was insane, Max Zorin. And Christopher Walken was a real coup de gad. Grace Jones, for that matter, she brought a different feel to the whole proceeding.
Yeah, and that's another thing I wanted to bring up, too, and I totally agree with you. You know what's the interesting thing is before I watched this like 1.5 times over the past 2 days.
I'm sorry.
That's
it's an old joke, sorry.
I know.
That's an old Roger Moore joke.
You've used that on me before. I can't remember for what it was, but I never picked up that he was like genetically engineered.
It's not. Yeah, it's
and it's very subtly. It's the whole KGB. It's the whole scene with Gogol, and then you like piece it together.
Well, exactly.
And then you piece it together where it's like, oh, they're genetically engineering the horses, and oh, the doctor is like Joseph Mengele.
Right.
The escaped Nazi. That guy's not good. I like what they try to do, but that character is like trying to be campy, but without being campy. That's how terrible that character is.
Yeah, he's not good in this film, but the actor Willoughby Gray, he was in several Hammer horror films, and he was really well renowned. He was also the king, I read, in The Princess Bride, one of my favorite films.
Oh.
So he was not good in this film, I agree with you, but he was playing the Joseph Mengele type character, and he did genetically engineer apparently both the Max Zorin and the horses. But that's one of the questions I was going to have for you. The plot. Please articulate the plot to me, Frank. Is it horse doping? It's genetic engineering. You got your Nazis. You got your computer chips. There's a lot stuffed in here. A lot.
That's, you know what the funny thing is I was like literally going to ask you the same thing. But before I address that, I just want to say that I always forget Dolph Lundgren's in this, and he's in that scene, and that's a lot of fun because I feel like he could have been a good henchman in a Bond movie. Like, you know, so he could have been a better Stamper than Stamper and Tomorrow Never Dies or something. Okay. He's very Red Grant-esque. But anyway,
based on this performance is how we got into Rocky IV, so good for him.
Right, and plus he was banging Grace Jones, so that's right. How everything got started, so good for him. Dropped out of MIT.
Which I'm not even sure how pleasurable that would be, but anyway.
So, the thing is...
I just said that.
Yeah, neither can I, but I'm going to roll with it. So, do you feel that Mayday is genetically engineered too, or she's just like this badass chick?
I had not considered that.
Because when that scene where it's like the reveal of like Zorin left the KGB and there's the whole genetic engineering thing, she just like lifts that dude up.
Yeah.
And doesn't even break a sweat. So I don't know if she's supposed to be like Zorin's project.
I had not considered that, but maybe.
Or if she's just super strong or both. Because I looked at it is like Zorin and the Nazi doctor were like going to turn her into a Captain America-esque thing where they like start messing with her genes, but she's already a good fighter, you know, when she's like training Zorin. So that was just kind of my interpretation this time. Okay, so.
Let me ask you this. What did you think of her character's arc?
I love her character, man. I think her character's cool. I think she.
The arc of the character.
I think it's a good arc. I think it's a good. You want to talk about a juxtaposition? Is her and Roger Moore in bed? It's like, yeah, no. Like Timothy, Pierce Brosnan or so. Like I could buy that, but it's like, oh, poor Roger Moore in this movie. But anyway, so I think her arc is really good. I like her that she's just like the baddie, or she's like the henchman. And then she kind of has a better redeemable arc than Jaws does in Moonraker, tell you that much.
Because Zorin betrayed her, she betrayed him, basically, is what you okay with that? Okay.
I like that. I think it works. I don't think what works is how the Nazi doctor is reacting to the way Zorin's reacting in the blimp. I think Christopher Walken is so good in this movie. It's ridiculous how good he is. I think he's so much fun to watch. And to address the overall plot of the movie, so I think there's like three major things going on here. There's the horse doping and the whole genetic thing that really doesn't go anywhere, but it's kind of a fun... how do you want to put it, gimmick for Zorin, because, you know, a lot of the James, all the Bond villains have some sort of attribute.
Physical affliction.
Correct. Right? And I think that's just like a fun thing for the villain to have in this movie. And then
I'm with you on that.
The second thing is he wants to flood Silicon Valley and then dominate the computer chip, or just the information age, but just the computer industry, the information industry.
Right.
And then what's the other one? Is there a third one? It's the horse doping and then blowing up Silicon Valley.
And then the genetic engineering
the genetic engineering is like stemmed from the horse doping thing. That's what they're, you know, and why
the
not
horse,
like
the horse, his horses won, even though they weren't really highly regarded. So they
correct.
Were, so that was part of it too.
I think that there's not really, I mean, what can you do with genetic engineering unless like Zorin was trying to create like an army of people to like take over the world, but why, you know, there would have to be some sort of there. But I think the whole Silicon Valley thing is very 80s. And I think that, you know, Christopher Walken looks very 80s. It's like Gordon Gekko.
The white hair, too, and the hair straight back.
The whole slick back, the tight suit type thing. But the plot's really not that interesting.
No, it's not.
I think,
and again, there's a lot packed in there, man.
There is, and it's only like 2 hours and 10 minutes or 4 minutes or something. It's very, it feels long for having kind of a lean runtime. And I think, you know what I really don't like about the movie, and it's kind of a shame because I get it, is Patrick McNee. I totally get why he's in the movie, and I think it's fun that he's in the movie. But, like, he and Roger Moore huffing and puffing around the stairs.
Oh, my God, that fight sequence. I've written it in my notes. The fight sequence. The stables. They're wearing velour tracksuits. It's not funny. It's not exciting. It's the worst fight sequence in the entire series. It's really, really bad. I couldn't believe it as I rewatched it. And you're right. They're old and they're wheezing and they're I don't want to think about it. It made me sick the second time or the last time I watched it the other day. Ugh.
Like,
is there anything redeemable about that scene? Then he puts the vial in the wrong hole, so in the place in the holder, and the mad doctor knew something was up. It's like, okay, whatever.
It's just not like. I get why Patrick McNee's in it. He's from the Avengers, and he's kind of he's a staple of British television and kind of their culture. And it's fun to have him in the movie, but like his dye job is not great.
Yeah, he's in a thankless role. Why he deserved better? I love Patrick McNee. He's an actor, and he brought something to the film here. But you know, why did Bond treat Tibbetts like, you know, he treated him like shit? I guess that was his role as St. John Smith to be come across as a real dick, but it didn't work for me. It just didn't work for me.
That's another thing I wanted to bring up. That what is it, St. John Smith? That is the worst name in the world.
Well, I used to say St. John Smith, so now I say St. John Smith. Whatever.
Because that's what it is, right? It's like St. John, but they pronounce it in a different. It's ridiculous. It's just a bad name. And the whole Tibbet thing is fine. It's like where he's treating him like shit. It's just kind of like fun, like let's poke fun at kind of like the English upper class type thing. And Roger Moore is very good at that. But the whole tracksuit thing, yeah, that's just not a great scene. And then he gets a thankless death in the laundromat, or not the laundromat,
car wash.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it's not great. And then Allison Duty, who
Jenny Flex.
Yeah, she's kind of not great either.
She's very attractive, though.
She is, and she was good in Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. That's right. I think those are the only two things I really know her from. And then who else we got? We got Tanya Roberts, who, not the best Bond chick, man.
Leave me, James!
I still think that, you know what, though? Maybe it works because her and Mayday are very
opposites.
And I think, I mean, maybe Tanya Roberts just makes Mayday better. Because I like Mayday, man. On this rewatch, I was like, it's just fun. It's different. You know, Grace Jones is very distinct. You know, she
you can't categorize her.
And she works. I think she's totally believable.
Yep. I upon rewatching, I came to a new appreciation of Mayday. I will say this too, which I don't think I ever noticed in the past. When Mayday and Bond are in the mine and they're trying to get out and the water's coming up, she sees Jenny Flex.
Yeah.
And it really was a good moment in the film. You could tell she was really upset and pissed off. And I could see where that might trip her over to the side of good and virtue. So, yeah.
For sure. She's got a good arc. And then I like how after the bomb goes off and you see Walken's reaction, you can't tell if he's upset because Mayday is dead or if because his plan didn't work out. And I think
when he's watching from the blimp, and then the car
blows up.
Yeah,
I think that's really good. My favorite scene with Walken is where he's got Bond in his study, and he's running his computer, and he's talking about like thoroughbreds and all that stuff. And he's taking those photos of Bond,
yeah.
And the computer's coming back, and it's like Watkins' reaction to each thing that comes up, like
kind of
like,
chuckling.
Yeah. I think he is so much fun in this movie. Now, my question when I was watching this is, do you think if this movie was made, say, with Timothy Dalton or Pierce Brosnan, it would have been better?
Not as written. That's a good question.
Because think about if they made, even if John Glenn did it, because John Glenn changes, he turns the page pretty quick on his filmmaking style once Timothy Dalton enters.
That's very true.
Enters, with the exception of Wayne Newton, which we'll get to, which I think is weirdly fun and kind of a good comment on our society. But anyway, because I think they would drop a lot of the campiness from the movie. The other thing I think of that's kind of irritating.
You said the same film. If they drop the campy stuff. Yeah.
If they drop the campy stuff and they keep walking and they keep Grace Jones, and then Zorin and Bond could be more so contemporaries, if that makes sense to you.
Oh yeah.
You know, say that's Universal true. Exports is competing against Zorin Industries for something. I think that would be very interesting, and I couldn't help but think about that when I was watching the movie again, because the fight scene between Walken. Okay, let me back up real quick. I love the whole set piece. I like the blimp on the Golden Gate Bridge. It's not the Golden Gate Bridge, is it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is the Golden Gate Bridge. I like that whole scene. I think it's cool. I think it's fun. We've never seen anything like that before. I mean, the only other thing I've seen a blimp in is Black Sunday. So
great movie.
It is totally a good movie. And another Walken movie. There
Bruce
you go.
Bruce Stern.
Bruce. No, Walken's no, not in it. Shaw. It's Robert Shaw and Bruce Stern. Yeah. So I think it's fun. I think it's a fun piece. And I just, James Bond beating up Zorin and then like he just kind of falls, starts laughing and then just kind of falls is interesting.
It is interesting.
And then the Nazi doctor goes into the safe that has sticks of dynamite.
That are taped together like in a Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah, it's scene. Like, are you guys going to blow open holes into a mine? It's like, why are there sticks of dynamite on
the safe.
Blimp? It's the only thing in the safe, too, mind you. I rewound it when I was watching it, and I'm like, there's nothing else in the safe but sticks of dynamite.
And then how about when Stacey Sutton is like, running in the field outside the mine, and Bond's trying to get her attention, and the blimp is like right behind her. She's clueless. Look out! How do you miss a blimp?
Oh my god!
And then they pick her up. They just snatch her off the ground. It's like, oh god! But I guess
and
I don't know.
And then the ending's not good either. The ending's as bad for me as the
opening. The fire truck chase.
No, not even that. I'm talking about like Q with the robot and Bond. Oh.
Robot.
In the shower. The robot. Yeah, but the robot is also, it's like Rocky IV, man. They have like the robot in Rocky IV because that's like the whole 80s thing, like Johnny Five and all that
shit.
The only reason the robot's in the movie. But since I've been bagging on it for a while, I want to pivot back to what's this guy's name? Patrick Bauchu? Bauchau?
Bauchau.
He's awesome. I've always liked him as an actor, and I like him a lot in this. He's very underplayed.
As Scarpine. Yeah, he is underplayed. He's not really given a lot to do.
His scar's really not all that great either. He's
good with the machine gun, I guess. Yeah, he did have a scar on his face.
But it's just, he's what I expect from a Bond movie as kind of one of the henchmen.
Yeah, I would.
He's just like classy.
Okay, I'm going to pivot from there and say, Lois Maxwell, I love you. Thank you so much for your contribution to the film series. You've been wonderful. She looks so matronly in this film, and she dressed matronly. It was so odd and striking to me. The other thing I noticed, she was wearing the same blouse when she first meets Bond in her office, and then she's wearing the same blouse at the Chantilly racehorse. It's the same racehorses. It's the same clothing. It's like, it's so weird. It wouldn't be the same day, obviously. So I just thought that was odd. But, you know,
it's a weird continuity thing.
It was weird. Take a look. It's true, too. But then also going back to Tanya Roberts, beautiful, beautiful woman. Truly one of the most beautiful women probably in the entire series, but probably the worst actress. She's just really bad. I never watched that 70s show, but she was on there for a long time. Charlie's Angels, I never watched her on Charlie's Angels. I did get a kick out of a role in Mallrats, Kevin Smith movie. Did you see that one?
No, I did, but I didn't know she was in it. I'm actually looking at her IMDb right now, and I don't know if I've ever seen her in anything other than this.
Go watch Mallrats. I like Kevin Smith's stuff. But anyway, yeah, she's a beautiful girl, but not very good actress.
Was she one of the angels?
I believe so, yes.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Yes, she was Julie Rogers. Yep, she was one of the Charlie's Angels starting in 1980.
Oh, so it wasn't part of the original?
No.
I have no idea about the show. I mean, did they just...
Farrah Fawcett.
I know Farrah Fawcett, but did they
Jacqueline
just...
Jacqueline Smith.
Did they just, like, recast eventually?
Oh, yeah. They recast several of the...
So they just kept new angels. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, no, I haven't... she hasn't done anything since 2005. So she's retired, it seems. Yeah, I haven't seen her, I don't think, in much of anything. And she's just not, she's very flat in this movie. Her and Moore don't have any chemistry.
No.
And I feel like Roger Moore and Grace Jones have more chemistry.
Oh, you know what? I'm mistaken. Sorry. Take me back. She was not in Mallrats. It was Priscilla Barnes who was in License to Kill. So I got those two screwed up. So sorry, people out there. I made a mistake. But yeah. What were you saying? I just had to clarify.
I was just saying how I felt that she was flat. Her and Moore didn't have any chemistry. And Grace Jones and Roger Moore have more chemistry than Tanya Roberts and Moore. And Tanya Roberts is supposed to be the lead Bond
girl.
She's
always a damsel in distress so much, and she's annoying the way she's always screaming for help. It was annoying.
One thing I do like a lot about this is when I was looking up the movie, I like the one sheet of the movie that is Moore and Grace Jones, where she's lighting, they're standing and they're like butts are touching and she's lighting a cigarette. I was actually looking on eBay to see if I can get like a cheaper original because that's a really cool poster.
Yep, it is a good poster.
But
Alan Hume, it did. Director of photography, did the last three Bonds, For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, View to a Kill, and also Return of the Jedi, which I don't think I knew.
I mean, the movie looks fine. The movie looks good. The whole problem with the movie is they don't know what they're doing with the direction of...
The character?
Of like the humor, and then the sexiness, and then the suspense, and then the plot. It's just kind of a mess, and it's interesting to see. It would be interesting to, I don't know, maybe hear about, which they're so guarded about the whole franchise, so it's not like Michael G. Wilson would ever say anything like disparaging, but it would just be interesting to wonder when they were conceiving it, or if what the original ideas were, because it almost seems like the finished result is a couple of different ideas that they just kind of mashed together.
Yeah, there was a bit, they were at a bit of a crossroads because it was mostly recognized it would be Moore's last. So, you know, whenever they know the actor's going to leave the role, there's it opens some doors and it closes some doors in terms of what you can do within the screenplay, I think. So I agree with you. It kind of a mishmash. They made some poor decisions. I didn't care for many of the action sequences, the fire truck chase. I did. There's the one moment that I saw James Bond in this film. The one moment, Frank, is when he's under the water with the Rolls Royce and they think he's drowned and he takes some air out of the tire. That was very cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I could see James Bond do. So, well done. That was well done.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yep. And then we talked about your favorite Gogol, Walter Gotell, returning, because that's another plot point. Apparently, Zorin worked for the Russians for a time and then defected and then basically told the Russians to screw off. So that was interesting.
Well,
too.
The way I took it is like it was the Russians were the ones that like genetically engineered him. And then he was just like, he, you know, what My whole thing with Zorin is I imagine that he was this super smart dude that the Russians found, recruited, and then engineered, and then he just became like this super mastermind. And then Zorin's like, well, fuck the KGB, because I'm going to go do my own thing and take over Silicon Valley. And I'm going to get Mayday, and then I'm going to get the Nazi doctor who worked on me. And then we're going to make money doing that with horses. But that's just kind of, yeah, it's a cool, that whole scene is one of my favorite scenes of the movie.
Okay,
is
cool.
when Gogol comes back to confront him. And then I like at the end how, like, Gogol's a hero.
He's always the hero. He's like an anti-hero, but he usually comes out on top. Yeah.
It's like I like how they bring him back, because it's like, of course, he's got to, like, you know, get his dude who went astray. So now all of a sudden, like, the guy that created Zorin is an ally, because Zorin is just off the chain.
I agree. I made a list here of a couple of comments that John Glenn made during the commentary. Please, I'd like to know what you think on these. Let me read through them. There's just a couple. The fire chase scene. He inserted a lot of humor, and he likened it to the early days of cinema and Harold Lloyd. Okay. Then he said basic visual humor is important, essentially, said, to the Bond films to be successful internationally. To me, there's no subtlety. There's no sophistication with this fire truck scene. And then also, how about when the ladder knocks off the top of that, the bed on the truck, and there's a man and a woman in bed, and you look at the truck, it's really dirty. It's like, it makes no sense. It's just really crazy to me. And then, oh, here's another one. During that fire truck sequence, a lot of police cars are getting wrecked, and John Glenn said, there's something very humorous about police cars being wrecked. Okay, thanks, John. And then also, once again, the American police are again being depicted as buffoons, just like in Live and Let Die, The Man with the Golden Gun, Diamonds Are Forever. It's like the kind of return to that. You know my point on that? The Americans are kind of looked at as buffoons in the film, or depicted as buffoons?
For sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so as far as the whole humor thing with, like, what you say about what John Glenn was saying about how it's important for it to film internationally, when I hear that, I hear that's just what, like, Eon is looking at some report, and it's like people on the other side of the world where these movies make money like when they're funny. So we need to incorporate more of this into the movie, because we'll make more money overseas.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right, I'm sure.
And I think that's just something that John Glenn was essentially forced to do. And
so he tried to make the best of it, I guess.
So he probably, exactly. So what John Glenn did was like, well, I like Harold Lloyd, and I like this, so I'm going to incorporate what I like into the movie, and it just doesn't quite work, which is whatever.
Whatever's right.
It's just, it's something that I've just grown accustomed to with the Moore movies, and for me, it really works in some of them, and then other ones, it's like this. It's just kind of a shame. Like, the whole car getting cut in half, and then him driving around, and it's obviously not Roger Moore in the car.
Correct.
It's like, I feel like they got to the point where it's like, we can't even cover it up that it's not Roger Moore, so we just need more shots of the sandy blonde-haired stuntman in the suit driving around. It's not good. I do like the Eiffel Tower set piece. That's fun.
The set piece is fine.
And then Mayday jumping off. That's awesome. That's a lot of fun.
That was really done too.
The whole thing with, like, the butterfly is a bit much, but you know what I'm talking about, the scene before that where it's like she poisons the guy with, like, a hook in the butterfly? I don't know.
Which doesn't seem like a very efficient or practical way to kill someone, but
it's just
whatever.
It's not trying to be funny.
It's gruesome, actually.
It's just not that good, though.
No, it's not. But the whole jumping off is pretty cool, and then she parachutes onto that boat. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. And then he steals the cab. And then the car gets cut in half, and Zorin, at least it ends with, like, Zorin picking her up on the boat, and then him just doing his diabolical laugh. So there is that.
I'm going to say something too about when Bond was holding onto the rope and the blimp was flying over San Francisco. You see the Transamerica building, and this is kind of an in-joke. And then he, I don't know, does he run into the antenna on top of the building or whatever? But the Transamerica, the Transamerica building was the building where United Artists was headquartered. So that was kind of an in-joke.
Nice.
Yeah. The film did, it did okay based on its budget, its filming budget, but it did show a regression from, I believe, Octopussy and even For Your Eyes Only. I'm looking at domestic. I know this is not worldwide, but domestic box office that is inflation adjusted. And A View to a Kill is fourth from the bottom. And Octopussy is seventh from the bottom. Where's For Your Eyes Only? Oh, it's one, two, three, four, sixth from the bottom. So the last three more Bonds did not fare all that well, relatively speaking. They all made money. They were all successful, but they were far from blockbusters.
Yeah, I can't imagine that A View to a Kill did all that well. So is Moore on the DVD commentary?
He was not.
Does he provide? He might have done some.
I have to say, I'm quite disappointed in when I watch a film commentary from the director and cast and crew. I want to hear what their thoughts are on the scene that's being depicted. I don't want to hear about how you got the role and how you went to lunch with Cubby and all this. That doesn't matter. I want to know how your insights relate to the film as I'm watching it. Maybe that's unrealistic. You can go into different tangents sometimes, but overall, that's what I look for in a commentary. So the commentary on this disc was especially non-informative, except for revealing John Glenn's real thought processes, which are kind of questionable. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do. I mean, what can you really say about A View to a Kill?
Well, when you're watching this, I'd like to know how they did talk a little bit about the mine blowing up, and there was some technical stuff that they talked about. I wanted to learn more about that stuff. That's just me, though. That's just me. So can I do my...
Yes, please.
Because it's going back to Christopher Walken. I'll never be able to replicate him, but more! I need more power! More power!
Oh, my God.
Let's say power. More power! I was going to do... Stacey Sutton, James, don't leave me. It's like she said it like eight times. Don't leave me. Oh, geez, please leave her. Leave her in that goddamn elevator shaft.
That was awesome.
Oh, yeah, right. Don't humor me. Don't fuck with me, dude.
I was waiting to see. I was hoping it was going to be Christopher Walken, but then at the same time, I was maybe imagining it might be the Nazi doctor.
You know what would have really been funny? If he would have said... More! I need more cowbell! I thought of that.
I get it, because the SNL skit.
Yes, I thought of that last night, and I cracked myself up. If no one else gets it out there, watch the Will Ferrell and Christopher Walken skit where he says, more cowbell on that Blue Oyster Cult song, Don't Fear the Reaper. Classic stuff, people.
That's classic 90s SNL.
So... Should we wrap up?
Yeah, I think that's probably...
I'm going to say this then. Yes, I'm going to say at the end of this film, it said James Bond will return. I would give this film a one, perhaps one and a half, grudgingly, out of 5 stars. And I will say...
I mean, it's not that bad.
Podcasting Them Softly For Your Ears Only podcast will return with no small amount of joy, if not relief... that the Roger Moore era has come to an end.
Oh, I bet you're really proud of that. So, unfortunately...
At the same time, love you, Roger. Thank you for all your stuff.
Unfortunately, the time that we spent with Sir Roger Moore is now over. So,
Fair enough.
We will now embark...
As a counterpoint.
We will now embark on the Timothy Dalton. So, we oftentimes would... spend the last couple moments speaking of updates on No Time to Die. So the problem that we're having, though, is Tom's being one of those people that won't watch the trailer because he doesn't want it spoiled for him, which I totally get because I've done that with movies too. So there's not much that we can actually speak of. because there's things in the trailer that Tom actually doesn't know about, which is surprising.
I've been successfully able to avert my eyes and avoid news.
I'm not about to spoil it for him, but hopefully by the time we do the Living Daylights podcast, Tom will have either seen the trailer or it gotten spoiled for him. But until then, there's not a whole lot to say about it. Other than I thought the trailer was awesome.
Well, that was my question. Did you like the trailer?
Yes, very much so. It's a very interesting turn that it looks like they're setting up. So
fair enough. And I'm looking forward to the film, which will be out in 3 short months. And
and then we'll be able to start speculating who they're going to cast as the next James Bond.
Maybe they'll bring they can't bring Roger Moore back, but apparently Grace Jones was touting Dolph Lundgren in the role during the shooting of this film.
And I'm sure.
It apparently rubbed Roger the wrong way. They didn't get along, reportedly.
That's what I'm reading. I'm reading that they did not care for one another. I'm also reading that. Yeah, I saw that. I read that in his biography. and he also did not like the movie.
No, he said it was his least favorite.
Yeah, so, I mean, there is that. So Roger Moore even knew he was making a heap of shit.
There you go.
But did the best he could with it. So,
well, out of five, what would you give it?
I would probably give it, like, 3 stars.
Are there Bond films that come below 3? In your mind? In your world?
Not,
I would guess.
Not really.
Die Another Day?
Die Another Day is the only... That's the only one that would... out of respect, I would give that movie like 2.5 stars, because there's things about it I like. There's just enough about it I don't like.
Yeah. That's how I feel about A View to a Kill.
Which is fine.
I'm glad I watched it again. I hadn't seen it in a long time. By choice.
It's been a while since I watched it, too, because I generally watch the Moore ones often. I've been wanting to rewatch I've been wanting to rewatch Casino Royale, but I've also been kind of like saving it, but we're probably not going to get to that for a while. So, yeah.
Well, let's get to Living Daylights in the next month or so.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
We'll start the Timothy Dalton era. Thanks to everyone sincerely for listening. It's always great fun. Frank, thank you so much, and have a great Sunday.
All right. You too, my man. Thank you.